Hello, and welcome to the Pancake Brains edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm joined by Emily Peck of HuffPost.
Hello.
Who has a big scoop this week all about how women's brains are like pancakes. My brain is more like a colander, to be honest. Things come through and it just comes straight out the other side. I retain nothing. But here to help me learn stuff, as ever, is Anna Szymanski of Breaking Views.
Hello.
We are going to be talking about WeWork because that is the big news of the week. What is going on with WeWork and its shareholder, SoftBank, its biggest shareholder, is now going to be 80% shareholder of WeWork. We are going to talk about Emily's big scoop about pancake brains. You learned this week from Ernst & Young that women's brains are like pancakes, whereas men's brains are like waffles.
That is correct. And it makes me hungry every time we talk about it.
So this is going to be a hungry-making edition of Slate Money. We are also going to talk about my book review and about this book called Darkness by Design by this chap called Walter Matthey and the theory he has, which I think I'm kind of convinced by, that the stock market all went to shit after 2005. That and a Slate Plus segment on Chile all coming up on Slate Money. Let's start by talking about WeWork, because in the annals of corporate implosions, there are many, but this one was impressive even by, you know, historical standards. It's not just the valuation falling from $47 billion to $8 billion in the space of like a blink of an eye. It's also just the way that the whole glorious edifice of unicorns and minotaurs and all of these other things that I, you know, that we talk about has just seems to have crumbled overnight. It's amazing.
So this week we're talking about WeWork again, because SoftBank has basically come to its rescue, right? They're putting in how much more money into the
company?
$5 billion. $5 billion.
Mostly debt, but they're also spending $3 billion buying up equity from employees, mostly from Adam Neumann.
Right.
They're spending $970 million buying Adam Neumann's shares from him, which seems like not the highest and best form of $970 million if you want to rescue WeWork.
Agreed, although I think obviously that's because they want to reduce his power. And, you know, but it is.
Well, they're doing that. This is the thing. They're doing that by paying him another $185 million in a quote unquote consulting contract, which is basically a payment for him to reduce his stake from 3 votes per share to 1 vote per share. Once he goes down to 1 vote per share, which he does for $185 million, then at that point he doesn't control the company anymore.
Right.
So you don't need to spend another $970 million buying back his stock.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons why SoftBank has structured the deal as they have. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, part of the reason that they've structured it as they have is because they want to basically have control without having voting control. I mean, it's a little complicated because they don't want to bring the liabilities onto their balance sheet.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. They say they're going to own 80% of the company when this is finished, but not control it, which I don't even know how that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It's accounting shenanigans is really what it is. And you understand why. Obviously, they don't want to bring all of those liabilities onto their balance sheet. But at the same time, you're like, okay, so now, like what, like $16 billion you've plowed into a company that you're saying is worth $8
billion? Right.
So wait, are you saying that if they control...
Well, $8 billion pre-money, but...
Are you saying that if they controlled the company, then they are that the SoftBank corporate would then become liable for those debts?
They'd have to put it onto their balance sheet. Yeah, there's a different accounting depending.
Well, I mean, I just want to know what you mean. You use that term. So they are liable. If WeWork defaults, then they have like a SoftBank guarantee for all WeWork debt at that point.
Well, yeah, and also it would just yes, and they would have to bring it onto their books, so then that would also degrade the quality of SoftBank.
Huh.
So now that, I mean, SoftBank, I guess, has temporarily come to the rescue because the company was about, I think it was going to run out of cash by November or something insane
like favorite, that. My favorite detail is the bit where they couldn't afford to fire people because they didn't have any money to pay them severance.
Right. That's always bad.
Like, so they're going to lay off, I guess, like 4,000 people, I read yesterday, and it's not clear
not
what
including
else.
Adam Neumann.
Right. And those people are understandably quite angry that Adam Neumann's walking away with about $2 billion.
It's a bit unclear. Like
$1.7 billion.
He has to use $500 million of the proceeds of his stock sale to pay down the bridge loan that he's getting from SoftBank. He owes, he's kind of in default already on $500 million that he owes to JP Morgan. So SoftBank is going to lend him that $500 million, take on that debt. But as soon as they buy the stock from him, he then needs to use that money to pay them back on the $500 million. So that leaves him with only $470 million, which he actually needs to pay a bunch of capital gains tax on that. So I don't know how much money he's actually going to end up with at the end. But according to Bloomberg, you know, he's still a billionaire. I don't think he's going to need to sell his house in the Hamptons.
Right.
No, so I mean, he has a lot of liabilities. I mean, he has a lot of loans outstanding, but you're right. At the end of the day, like, I think he'll be okay.
So I feel like a lot of the coverage this week was just like you're, as you'd expect, people being really angry at this guy, Adam Neumann. But then there was this like strand of reasoning that was like, what happened with WeWork was kind of like a victimless heist. Like Adam Neumann was kind of like an idiot savant ripping off rich people. He was kind of like a perverse Robin Hood kind of situation.
Right. I mean, basically, the losers here are the Saudi royal family who plowed a whole bunch of money into the SoftBank Vision Fund.
At what valuation?
And Masa Son,
right,
the Korean-Japanese billionaire, and all of these people who you really can't have a lot of sympathy for and who created this monster in the first place. It's, you know, the real losers are things like the janitors in WeWork locations who, you know, have been on WeWork's payroll, and now because they need to cut costs, they're all going to be fired and replaced by some like subcontracting nightmare.
Right. And they're not going to get, you know, millions of dollars in severance or consulting fees for the other cleaners to help them when they take over. So it's not entirely victimless, but it's not like there's not seemingly as much contagion from like other big company implosions. That,
although there's a lot of,
but I want to talk about the real estate.
A lot of companies are like going down, like Amazon, Twitter, they're all kind of, you know, they're coming out with earnings and people. Like, I feel like right now there's something in the air that stock market investors are going to grabbing onto any excuse to be bearish and downgrade companies. And this is what we saw with WeWork. The reason why WeWork is in such trouble is because they filed to go public and they wanted to go public at some, you know, enormous valuation of like $50 billion plus. And investors were like, no. And then, so then what happened is the underwriters said, well, okay, if you won't buy it at a $50 billion valuation, will you buy it at a $20 billion valuation? And in most normal markets, if it's remotely reasonable that people will buy it at 50, then they'll definitely buy it at 20. And this market doesn't work like that. They get offered this like 60% discount and everyone goes, yeah, no, like if it doesn't make sense at 50, it doesn't make sense at 20. And it probably doesn't even make sense at one. Like it's just like this horrible cash burning monster and I want nothing to do with it. And that was the real problem, is that it's not that the valuation went down. It's just that the valuation just evaporated.
Right. And I think that this goes back to what we've talked about a little bit when we were talking about IPOs in general, and specifically when we were talking about Uber and Lyft, and just this fact that the markets are not as willing to believe these stories about these firms that do not create profits, that have no real path to profitability. And I think WeWork is just this kind of extreme example of this.
Yeah. And it does seem like some kind of delusion has lifted from everyone's eyes, heads.
Except for Masa Son. Like,
well, even Masa Son, even there was a piece in the journal today that SoftBank was pivoting to making money. Like they're right. Prioritizing the investments they've already made and trying to work on corporate governance and getting more profits out of what they already have.
It's true, but like, I don't know. This is part of me. It's like, A, the way the Vision One fund was set up and the way that not only were they giving companies just way too much capital, it was basically structured so that they had to spend it quickly, which is just pretty much a horrible idea.
No, I mean, you're right that the Vision Fund was set up that way. They can't. That's sunk cost at this point. That's water under the bridge. The question is, when Masa goes to Riyadh next week to the Future Investment Initiative and pals around with his friend Mohammed bin Salman, and he's trying to get another, you know, $50 billion or whatever for Vision Fund 2. Is he going to say, well, Vision Fund 2 is going to have this same structure and the same idea as Vision Fund 1? Or are we going to do what Emily said and like pivot to trying to make money?
But then at a certain point, then like what's like almost what's the point of that? Like in the sense of Masa-san's whole idea is like, I have this 300-year vision, and that's why you're giving me all this capital that I'm plowing to all these companies. And it's like, okay, now what does he have? Well, he has a company that he's plowed the $16 billion into that fundamentally rents real estate. Like, well, that is a harder sell to people. Like, give me billions so that we can expensively rent real estate.
We don't know that Vision Fund 2 is going to invest in WeWork.
No, I understand.
And SoftBank needed to rescue WeWork just to protect the money it had already put in.
No, it didn't,
and
though.
So that's an interesting question, right?
I think it had to do it before.
Was it ever possible that SoftBank could just sit back with its existing stake, watch WeWork put together a financing deal from JP Morgan, let Adam Neumann retain control of the company, and, you know, sort of just sit on the sidelines as a passive investor? Was that realistic?
Just two things. Like, one, I think that the debt deal that JPM was trying to put together never made any sense.
I agree
with you on that totally. However, I feel like if you're looking at the Vision Fund's stake was like $2 billion because the rest of it was just put in by SoftBank. So, like, they could have just written that down. That's a small percentage in the grand scheme of the Vision Fund. To me, this is just, it is a walking, talking sunk cost fallacy. Like, he does not want to admit that he made a massive error.
Although, you know, if he's throwing good money after bad.
Like,
if you do invest on a 300-year time horizon, then it is almost certain that at some point your assets on a mark-to-market basis will go down by like 90%. And you just need to have the courage of your convictions, Anna. The 300-year thing is hilarious. I don't know if you saw that wonderful bit about Adam Neumann where he was talking about how in literally 300 years' time, he wanted his great-great-great-great-granddaughter to be walking into a board meeting and say, like, but are you really elevating the world's consciousness?
You had one amazing statistic. I think it was in your newsletter where it said for every dollar WeWork lost, the share price rose $10.
I mean, that wasn't entirely scientific. But it was more or less the idea that, like, people would put money into WeWork precisely because, the bigger the losses, the faster the growth, the greater the valuation. And the WeWork, sales pitch, really. The Adam Neumann sales pitch was, I can just keep this rocket ship growing by losing more and more money. So the more money you give me to lose, the more money you will make.
It's a Ponzi scheme.
And it's a little bit Ponzi-esque, to be true. And the people who won were, you know, commercial landlords and people like that who just got to lease out their Class A office buildings all over London and New York and San Francisco.
This is interesting to me just because, like, Minsky, like, when he talks about, like, the kind of different stages of bubbles, the last one he always says is when you essentially have these Ponzi loans that just make no rational sense. And to me, like, this all comes back to something I know I've said 150,000 times, but it's just we have so much capital trying to find a home. And that's often, frankly, because of, like, income inequality. But as a result, it's not as surprising that you're going to have these ridiculous things because there just aren't enough amazing things to plow money into.
Sounds like it's time for a wealth tax, Anna.
I still don't believe in a wealth tax. That does not mean I don't think we need to dramatically reduce inequality. I just think that a wealth tax is not the best way to get there.
Just raise some taxes if there's so much money slashing around.
Raise taxes on Adam Neumann.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
I mean, I do have a thing that I put in my newsletter every so often, which is ban private jets. And I do think that the WeWork private jet was really the sign that this thing was out of control. The way that he would go surfing in the Maldives, and then while the S1 was being put together, he would, like, send his private jet to pick up executives from New York and fly to the Maldives to meet him because he didn't want to miss, like, a good wave.
We were just talking about this, and meanwhile he was going to NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange and telling them they had to ban meat and plastic cups
from their cafeterias.
And he was in the Maldives, which is literally like under the water. And
there should be some kind of private jet indicator, Felix. Cook something up.
I feel like any startup, any pre-IPO company with a private jet, just short all of them.
Blacklist.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Emily.
Yeah.
Can we talk about waffles?
Well, I'll try, but my pancake brain may not be able to explain this to you.
So, I mean, I know that you're a woman and all, but maybe you can explain what happened to Ernst & Young.
I'll do my best. So this week I published a story about Ernst & Young, or EY as they're called, about a training they held in June 2018 for executive women. It was called Power, Presence, and Purpose, and it was billed as like women's empowerment. But I obtained this, the presentation used, it's like a 55-page document from this presentation, and I was working on it for a while, so I stopped being shocked by it. But when I put out the story, the reaction was pretty, people were shocked. Basically, there's a whole section on appearance. Women should take care not to wear short skirts, not have bottle blonde hair. They shouldn't speak with a shrill or high-pitched voice. Then there was some shocking things they were told about their brains. So women were actually literally told that women's brains are 6 to 11% smaller than men's brains.
What?
And it's not clear why they were told this. I spoke to a woman who attended who was just appalled by the whole thing. And I kept pressing her like, well, okay, so they told you women's brains are small, but did they tell you why this is relevant? And she said, no. I even called a neurologist at Rockefeller University and I was like, these women were told their brains are small. And he was like, the reason you tell women their brains are small is to make them feel stupid. That's all. And women were also told, this is where pancakes and waffles come in. They were told, women's brains are like pancakes. When you pour the syrup is the information. When you put the information onto their brain, they absorb it, you know, like a pancake, like flat. But men's brains are like waffle brains. So when you pour the syrup on a waffle, as I'm sure we all know, the syrup collects in each little waffle square. So men are able to compartmentalize the information. But at this presentation on women, again, I'll repeat, empowerment presentation, women's empowerment presentation, they were told that if you show too much skin as a woman, it would scramble the brains of the men who
it would scramble their waffle brains. I feel like we're mixing breakfast metaphors.
It was a lot of scrambling and syrup, and every time I talk about it I get a little hungry. but yeah, so I wrote about it, and I even like got on the phone to a bunch of women who do like leadership training for women to be like, am I like overreading this? Like, is there a reason this presentation is like that? They went through a list of like invisible rules that went through these stereotypes about women, like in conversations, women, you know, ramble and miss the point. You can't talk face to face with a man because I'm looking at Felix as I say this, because it intimidates them.
I'm so intimidated.
And they
right
feel
now.
Angry or whatever.
But honestly, my brain is scrambled because like you're wearing like the wrong clothes. And yeah,
it's awful. So yeah, so I had these three experts kind of look at it, and they all just said, I don't see any utility. Like, it's useful
to
go over.
Was it all like this? Was this just bits of it?
This is the most shocking bits.
So,
yes.
And then this was run by a woman called Marcia Clark.
Not that one.
Who, did she only do this at Ernst & Young, or did she do this all over the shop?
She had many other clients she lists on her website, I think including JPMorgan Chase and PepsiCo, a host other clients that she names.
Presumably, yeah. She did the same thing at these other companies.
I think
too.
So. I mean, I look through some of her other materials, and the brain stuff comes up in them. To be fair, there are women who say, I had a few write to me who say, I took Marcia Clark's, you know, training, and you're really underselling it. I thought it was really valuable and empowering. And women, generally speaking, even at these like fix the women type trainings where women are told the reason you're not getting ahead is because you're not doing it right or whatever. The experts I spoke to say even at those kinds of places, just getting all the women together in a room is somewhat empowering because you get to meet other people who are in similar positions.
Is this like a post lean in kind of thing where like women are told that if they change their behavior or do this rather than that, then they can have more success? I feel like there was a wonderful piece that came out, I can't remember where it was, a couple of years ago, where some woman went to sort of 27 consecutive women's empowerment conferences in a row, and they all just started merging into a gray glob of you go girl.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has always been how it is in corporate America. Women are told, look, if you just, you know, you just go learn how to play golf, drink right. more martinis, you know, wear shoulder pads. If you just fit in and learn how to do it, then you will succeed.
Well, and what I think is interesting, too, if you kind of look at how the advice has changed. I mean, I feel like back in the 80s, it was much more like kind of be like a man, right?
Right.
That was the kind of golf shoulder pads thing. And then it kind of shifted to this idea of like, well, no, people don't like women who try to be like men. So now you have to walk this weird balance where you're traditionally feminine. However, you're also assertive and, you know, taking your place at the table. And you're like, these things seem to contradict each other.
But don't be blonde.
Or don't be blonde.
Don't
apparently.
Be bottle blonde, according right. to the presentation. You can be blonde. Oh, and we should say that the chairwoman of EY in the US is a woman, Kelly Greer.
What color is her hair?
And her hair is blonde. and although, did you know that female CEOs are more likely to be blonde? Like the percentage of women leaders who are blonde is like 30%, although in naturally occurrence of blonde people is like 5%.
Well, they can afford it.
Sidebar. But she came out and she said, if I had taken the advice, so EY finally admitted, oh yeah, this was a mistake and it was offensive. And she said, if I had actually taken the advice in this training, I would never have made it to the top of the company well, myself.
And this is a thing that I feel like is interesting recently because, you know, with the Me Too movement, you often had this kind of generational thing where you had younger women being like, no, we shouldn't just have to kind of put up with this. And then sometimes you had older women being like, well, you kind of have to do this to get ahead. And, you know, I kind of feel like the younger women have proven that they're right, which is that if you keep just saying, well, no, these are the rules, so we have to follow these rules. And, well, men make the world, so we just kind of have to go with it. Then literally nothing will ever change.
Yeah, nothing will change. And I did hear from a few women who, so Marsha Clark, who did the training, she worked at EDS, which is the Ross Perot, Texas, tech
oh, wow.
company.
Famous for its haircut rules. Not just for women, but for men. Like you had to wear white shirts, you had to have short hair. There was a whole bunch of like the dress code there was insane.
So that's where she was spent the 20 years as an executive. So it must have been I can only imagine because she refused to talk to me, but it must have been just a bitch to be a woman there. I can't imagine it was easy. And so the strategy, like Anna was saying, of going around the men or working within the system they've sort of laid out for you is the only way to survive. Like, you're not going to survive at Ross Perot's company if you're, you know, just decide to be yourself.
Can you talk a little bit about this whole sort of women's leadership industrial complex and whether it's got any utility whatsoever?
Well, like I was saying before, I think there are women who just find it valuable, especially those who are working in industries with very few of them, to just be put in a room with other women who have similar jobs and problems. It feels good to just get together. But if they're just given vapid, lean-in kind of advice, that's not, you're going to walk away from that and it's empty, right? You're not going to be helped by that. But maybe theoretically, if the training helps you think about how to change the culture in your firm, maybe then something can be done. Like one of the trainers said to me, like, there's this phenomenon that happens like at work where like women wind up doing like the administrative tasks. Like if you're in a room, like the woman goes to get the coffee, the woman organizes the birthday cake celebration, does all this crap. And you don't even think about it half the time because you're like, oh, Stacey's just really good at like getting the card and getting everyone to sign it. And, you know, and Melinda's really good at like bringing the cake or whatever. But it's bad to have only women doing that kind of stuff. So if a training would maybe call your attention to that and then you can go back to work and then you, a senior woman, can see that the junior women are all going and doing all these like secretary-esque kind of things, you can like put a stop to that. And this is a very minor thing, obviously, but
no, it's important.
If there's a way you can kind of shift, you can teach women in these trainings to shift the culture, that could be helpful. But to my mind, I'm like, well, why can't you teach the men that too? Like, why does it have to be sex segregated?
And the other question, the other big question I have is how much of this is on EY? Like, to what degree is this a situation where a bunch of women's groups within EY were like, we should have some leadership training coming in, and the EY people are like, okay, have some leadership, and then they bring in this Marsha Clark woman, and then like, can you blame EY for this, or is this just something that they had their heart in the right place, they just wound up hiring the wrong person by mistake?
I mean, EY is a big, well-managed company, and I mean, the CEO, the chairwoman herself said, like, we typically vet vendors and we vet training. And she said, mistakes have been made in this case, and they didn't do that vetting. So I think we absolutely can blame EY. They were spending thousands upon thousands of dollars to get this training done. No one looked into what it was. No one thought about it. Yeah, maybe they thought they were just checking a box. I don't know. I'm speculating.
I mean, I think you're right that obviously this is an extreme example. But honestly, like, when I was looking at this, I'm like, this actually didn't surprise me that much, because you see this in this, like, kind of, as you said, Felix, this kind of like women's empowerment industrial complex. Like, you do see a lot of this stuff. And to me, like, I am just, I've never been a fan of this stuff in general, because even though I agree with you that, yes, sometimes maybe you can point out things that people can change, I think, you know, the bigger issue is just that once more women are in power, both men and women, their understanding of what it means to be a leader, what a leader looks like, changes.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think of this example a little bit with Elizabeth Warren, you know, in relation to Hillary Clinton, that I'm not saying that there isn't sexism directed at Elizabeth Warren. However, I feel like the discussion around her has been very different. And I feel like part of that is because maybe, like, Hillary Clinton, to a certain extent, made people more comfortable with the idea of having a woman in this position. And then now people are, I'm not saying they're over it, but things have changed a little bit.
Yeah, one of the pieces of research I looked at was pretty old, from the 90s, I guess, but it looked at law firms with small percentages of women versus law firms with higher percentages. And in the ones with a small percentage of women, people really believed in all the sex stereotypes you could even come up with. You know, men are more aggressive, women are more soft-spoken and caring, blah, blah, blah. When there weren't that many women in senior partnership roles, everyone believed that, you know, that men are from Mars and women are from Venus or whatever. But in the firms where there were more women in leadership roles, the stereotypes kind of fell away a bit more, because you got to see it to know what it is. So instead of doing the training, just hire more women. It's so
and
much
the,
easier.
The reason I also think that that's important is because they often show that when you have these, like, training programs that, you know, men might have to go through, it makes them more sexist. Just, yeah, like, you know, so yeah, that's why I'm kind of true. Like, maybe just, like, have more women in leadership and then don't have these stupid training programs that everyone hates.
I think that's right. Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
I would like to talk about my book review. Can I talk about my book review?
Go for it, Felix. Didn't everyone already read your book review?
I don't think everyone has read my book review. We've got a special link in the show notes this week, which I'll make sure Jessamine puts in, which has lots of extra numbers and letters and things so that it gets around the paywall so that everyone can read it for free, because the foreign affairs paywall can be hard to navigate.
So Felix has a big piece in Foreign Affairs about why the stock market is totally a mess and ruined, and he explains everything.
Well, the person who explains everything is this guy called Walter Matley, who wrote this book called Darkness by Design. And I kind of wanted to hate this book, because when I looked at the book, when I first picked it up, I thought it was tirade against high-frequency trading. And I remember the last time I read a tirade against high-frequency trading, it was called Flash Boys by Michael Lewis. And there was lots of, you know, anecdote and white hats and black hats and goodies and baddies. And it was deeply unconvincing. And I wrote a long book review in Slate about that one. This one, I feel, is different. He's not claiming that mom and pop investors are being ripped off. He's just making a very simple claim, basically, that there was this kind of golden era, I would say between about 2000 and 2005, although he goes way, way back to the New York Stock Exchange, back decades and decades. And he basically says when the New York Stock Exchange had a monopoly on stock market trading, that was good for the market as a whole. When it wasn't owned by the big banks, when it wasn't a for-profit corporation, like, that was good. It had a huge amount of incentive to regulate everyone, to keep a level playing field, to make sure trading was smooth. And then when everything, like, exploded after 2005, when there are now 23 different exchanges, there's no one who can do that anymore. Regulators can't do that anymore. All of the exchanges are incentivized to basically do whatever the high-frequency traders want them to do, because that's where all their money comes from.
And you had this great anecdote, I guess it's from the book, that sort of is a signifier of how well-regulated the New York Stock Exchange used to be, and it involves a guy who went to the bathroom.
So, yeah, there was this market maker in the New York Stock Exchange, and his job was to ensure smooth, continuous trading of whatever stock it was he was market making in. And this doesn't exist anymore. This job, like, technically exists, but realistically, no one is breathing down these market makers' necks saying, you need to make sure that if the last trade was at, you know, $75, the next trade can't be at $74. It needs to go smoothly down. It can't jump down. No one's in charge of that anymore. But back then, this is back in the 1980s, that was his job. And this stock was trading down. And he could see that it was trading down. And he's like an expert. And he was doing a good job at making it trade down smoothly, and he was buying the stock. He was the main buyer of the stock while everyone else was selling. And of course, the more he bought, the more he lost, because the stock was going down. But that was his job, was basically to lose money in cases, in situations like that, and provide liquidity and make sure that the trading was smooth. And then he did this for like 4 hours and then really needed to pee.
Which happens.
He got his assistant to take over and miscommunicated to his assistant basically what the job was. He's like, don't buy too much of this because it's still got a lot further to fall. And his assistant didn't buy. He wasn't putting new money in to keep the trading smooth. And the stock, like, gapped down 75 cents. And then he came back after peeing. He was gone for like 7 minutes. And he got this $50,000 fine because he didn't keep the stock trading smoothly. And the guy at the exchange on the, you know, the sort of discipline panel board basically said, he did such a good job for 4 hours. He lost loads of money. It's not like he was, you know, doing a bad job. And the guy, and they said, no, we're going to fine him, because don't tell me that he stopped at like 20 lights before blowing through the red mm-hmm. one. Like, it's, you know, and that culture was a super interesting culture. And I think it was a good culture. And I think on some level, that guy who paid the fine knew that it was better that way. He expected to be fined. When he came back from the bathroom and he saw what had happened, he's like, ah, shit, I'm going to get a fine now. And then he paid his fine, and he was glad on some level to pay his fine, because he knew that everyone else would be fined the same way, and that everyone was going to be held to this super high standard. And if everyone is held to that super high standard, then everyone wins. Now, no one is held to that super high standard and everyone loses.
So what's changed? So now stocks go down 75.
Now there are mini flash crashes. This is something I learned in the book. There are mini flash crashes in more or less every stock, more or less every day. There are, like, especially the big stocks like Google and Apple and companies like that, they can drop a huge amount, like many dollars per share in like a microsecond, and then it will come back up a microsecond later. And there's no one preventing that.
Right. But isn't there like bid-ask spreads, especially among like large cap stocks, mm-hmm. have declined?
So that's true. The bid-ask spread, there are two different things that happened. And this is why I say that the golden era is between 2000 and 2005. 2000 was decimalization. And 2000, when you stopped trading stocks in like an eighth of a dollar or a sixteenth of a dollar, and you just traded them in dollars and cents. And once you were able to trade every stock in increments of 1 cent, that brought the bid-ask spreads down. The degree to which a tight bid-ask spread is really necessary or sufficient for liquidity is something we can debate but put to one side for the time being. But generally, a smaller bid-ask spread is a good thing. And that happened after 2000 when they decimalized. And then in 2005, they did this thing called Reg NMS, which basically created this explosion of stock exchanges. And it meant that the New York Stock Exchange lost its monopoly and became a for-profit corporation. And that didn't, the bid-ask spreads did not widen out after that, but they didn't particularly narrow much either. But that was, it's 2005, which is when things went bad.
Right. I think there's a little bit of a difference if you're talking about large cap versus small cap, because I think small cap, the bid-ask spreads have not narrowed as much as they have in large cap, just because right. you do have so much volume, and because those tend to be where high frequency traders really kind of right. consolidate.
You can make a good living as a high frequency trader, just trading Apple stock.
Right.
You know. So.
And if there are huge gaps, I mean, that's also an arbitrage opportunity.
So if there are these little flash crashes during the day, are people making like a ton of money off the yeah, little flash crashes?
Absolutely.
So
and it's the algo bots and the HFTs and the, you know, people like Virtue and people like that who are making the money. It's not real money investors.
And no one is policing those big profit bumps off the little flash crashes.
Correct.
That's what you say in the piece.
And in fact, quite the opposite. The stock exchanges are all competing with each other to attract those traders mm-hmm. and trying to make it as easy as they can for those traders to make that money. Because the more money that you can make trading like mini flash crashes in Apple, for instance, the more money you're willing to pay that exchange for like co-locating your computer server or something like that, which, by the way, was illegal under SEC regulations for a good 5 or 6 years before like the stock exchanges finally asked permission to allow co-location. And then the SEC said, yeah, sure, you can do that, and retroactively made it legal. You know,
so,
it's ridiculous.
So in your piece, you say our concept of who the little guy is kind of crazy in the stock market world, where we think the big guys are like the Fidelities and the big brokerages, but actually they're also little guys. And it's the HFTs have sort of like taken over these stock markets. And it's
so there's three different players that I think of in the stock market very broadly. One is the kind of people that Michael Lewis would consider to be the little guy, the mom and pop investors, the people with their Charles Schwab account or their Morgan Stanley brokerage account or something like that. They're buying and selling individual, you know, shares, doing individual trades. And now we just had the news today, like if you have the Square Cash app, you can trade stocks on your phone through the Square Cash app. And that's just like dreadful. Don't do that.
It's
a very bad idea. But like that, so that's one idea of the little guy.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that most people with most brokerage accounts are actually quite rich. The kind of people who trade the stock market, you know, the kind of people who subscribe to barons, you know, the kind of people who like consider themselves to be individual investors.
It's mother and father, not mom and pop.
They have like seven figure sums invested in the stock market. These are not poor people. Whereas the actual, you know, broad middle classes of America, they don't have brokerage accounts. What they have is insurance policies and pension funds and things like that. And they wind up investing invisibly via these huge institutional investors. So, you know, that some massive insurance company is going to want to buy like a million shares of IBM. And that's what's really impossible now in this fragmented market, because it's the big insurance company wanting to buy a million shares of IBM who winds up getting front run and picked off by the HFTs.
I wrote down, stock market is rigged, a scam, but also where all my retirement money and college savings for my kids is.
Correct.
What now?
Anna?
Well, I guess I'm just kind of curious, and I've not read the book, so I obviously, yeah. But I'm curious what is the actual impact, dollar impact of the potentially having HFTs like front running? Like, because my question is.
Well, I mean, you can tell that by looking at two things. Number one is the profits that the HFTs make. And certainly if you're looking at Knight and Citadel and Virtue, they make billions and billions of dollars. So those billions of dollars are coming from somewhere, and then they're coming from mostly from big institutional investors. But in fact, it's bigger than that, because you also need to look at the profits that the exchanges make. There are 23 different exchanges out there, plus all of the futures exchanges and the foreign exchange exchanges and places like that. They all make billions of dollars as well. And most of those billions of dollars, in one way or another, come from charging rents to the HFTs. The HFTs pay billions of dollars for co-location services and that kind of stuff. So add those $2 billions of dollars together. And then on top of that, add in all of the extra few billion dollars that the HFTs are paying to do things like build super fast microwave transmission, you know, lines between exchanges for arbitrage purposes and that kind of stuff. And that all of those billions give you a pretty good idea of how much money is being skimmed off here.
So the HFTs are kind of like in control rentiers on the whole stock market. They're social.
Well, the exchanges are the rentiers.
HFTs are just these socially useless monsters that run everything. But then when you have, like, to go back to WeWork, like.
And to be clear, they're not actually socially useless, because one of the things they do is allow good stock trading for mom and pop investors, but that's just not worth it.
Okay. So, but what I was going to ask was, in the case of WeWork, right, everyone, the story about the company is that because it was going to go public, it finally got exposed as a scam because investors wouldn't let that happen. But if those investors don't matter, why did they have to have a say in what gets to go public? Does that make any sense?
So the HFTs don't generally participate in IPOs, you know?
Okay.
But they'll participate on, like, after 0.005 seconds.
Okay.
After the IPO. And then they'll start, like, arbitraging the stock and trading the stock up and down in a fraction of a second. But the big, like, asset allocation decisions about should I buy this stock, should I not buy this stock, how much should I buy it for as a fundamental investor holding for the long term, those decisions they have no interest in.
So they have all this power, but they're not using it fully, so that the
they're
big
not using
institutional
it for,
investors still have some kind of
yeah,
say.
They're not using it
the
for price
operates.
Discovery. So one of the main things that the market does is this thing called price discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this convention that, like, if you want to know how much a company is worth, what you do is you look at the stock price and you multiply it by the number of shares outstanding and you get the market cap, and that's mm-hmm. how much the company is worth. And the reason why we have that convention is because we understand that the stock market is a price discovery mm-hmm. mechanism, and that the price of the stock at any given time is the best price we have to give an idea of how much the company is worth. And yeah, HFTs are not bad for price discovery, but they're not good for price discovery. They're just not really part of that market.
Well, and there's one other thing with HFTs that I think can be an issue, in that what they can often sometimes do, even if it's just in like microseconds, is amplify movements that are already happening in the market. And by doing that, they can actually widen bid-ask spreads.
Right.
Exactly, right? And so that is an instance where you would think, oh, well, they're adding this kind of volume to the market that should narrow, but it doesn't always.
Yeah, it's not good liquidity. It's bad liquidity. It's like not all volume is good volume, and not all volume is liquidity. There's a lot of it is just what Larry Summers would call noise trading.
Mm-hmm.
And noise trading is not a great way to be able to provide large numbers of shares to institutional investors, or to be able to provide, you know, so that kind of important liquidity is does not show up in volume figures. And the other thing the HFTs do, of course, is this thing called stuffing. So you can look at the order book. There's this public order book in the stock market, and you can see how many, you can see, like, let's say there's a share which is trading at $75. You can see a whole bunch of orders at $74.99 to buy, and a whole bunch of orders at $75.01 to sell. And, you know, and then you can also see how many orders there are at $74.95 or $74.90 or $73 or $72 to see how much actual demand there is. And that used to be really useful, that order book, and people could learn about where the demand was for the stock at any given time. Now it is completely useless because all of those orders are spoofed, they're fake, and they are never intended to be filled. They've been put in by HFTs.
And one other thing, and other people may disagree with me about this, but I also think, like, you meet a lot of people who work at some of these shops, and they're brilliant. They're super, super smart people. And there's sometimes a time where you're like, is this really the best use of all of this brain power? Like, it just seems that, you know, and you understand why people do it, right? Because it can be very, very lucrative, but it does raise the question of, you know, how this benefits society.
Parasites.
Yeah, I mean, that's Lord Turner, right? Adair Turner's big thing about socially useless financial innovation. This is the classic socially useless financial innovation. The only real positive externality from all this is slightly faster telecommunications. And that's about it.
Burn it all down.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's have a numbers round. Anna, do you have a number?
I do. My number is 800 billion. 800 billion Brazilian real.
So what's that, like $200 million?
Close, 195-ish.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, pretty, not bad. Yeah, so if you're in the emerging market investment, Brazilian pension reform has been this thing people have talked about for like
Brazilian pension reform.
Over 20 years. It's been one of these things I was like, Brazilian pension reform. Well, it's finally happened.
Yay.
You finally had Brazilian pension reform. And granted, it was actually like extraordinarily needed. Like the Brazilian pension system was an absolute mess. Like if they hadn't fixed it, you'd get to a point where like 20% of GDP would be spent on pensions, which is, let's just say, not entirely sustainable. So this 800 billion reais is like the kind of estimated savings over a decade. And so it's a big deal. Now, granted, I don't love the person who pushed it through.
So savings being like the amount the pensions have been cut?
It's not necessarily the amount. It depends on what you mean by that, right? Because a lot of what they've had happen is...
Well, what's the delta here? What the 800 billion is the delta between what and what?
So the difference is between if they had not had the reform and the savings, if obviously now that they do have the reform. And the difference, yes, is the fact that people are going to have to retire at later ages and they are going to have to contribute more to their pensions, which, yes, but the reality is like... the system was completely unsustainable. Like,
okay, so, right. But, okay, so now Brazilians will be retiring later.
A few years later.
And they will be paying more money into their pension plans.
Right, but it won't completely blow up their economy, which is kind of important.
My number is £5.50.
I just had a heart attack because I thought it was my number, but it's not.
£5.50 is the new cheapest fare on the Heathrow Express. I don't know. Have you guys both taken the Heathrow Express? The Heathrow Express is the most expensive train in the world. Like, it used to be that you would have to pay up to £25 for a single on this thing. This is the fast train. It's super fast. It's super efficient. It's by far the easiest and quickest way to get from Heathrow into London. Go straight into Paddington. No stops. But ludicrously expensive. Except now, there is this new thing called Crossrail. and Crossrail is competing with the Heathrow Express. And it used to be that the Heathrow Express people were like, well, we need to charge this much money because something, something, investment, something, something, fixed cost, something, something, you know, recoupa, something, something. And people would grumble, but there's nothing they could do about it. The minute that Crossrail turns up, they're like, oh, actually, turns out we can sell fares for £5.50.
Competition.
Funny
Yay.
How that works out. Yes, I did take that because I was recently in London and I had not been in London for a little while and I was just not thinking and I got in and I just got in a cab and I was like, take me to Canary Wharf. And 2 hours later, wow. like £200, I was like, and I'm taking the tube on the way back.
Oh my gosh. My number is 5 hours. That is the workday at this small German tech company that was written up in the Wall Street Journal this week. And it's founded by this man who I didn't write down his name, but his last name is Ryan Gans. And he has like 15 employees or something. And at his last job before he started his own company, he asked his bosses, he said, can I work less hours and I'll take a pay cut to do it because I want to spend more time with my family. They were like, fine. So he started working fewer hours, but he found he was still doing the same work. His productivity didn't change at all. So he went back to his bosses and he said to them, I want my salary reinstated because I'm still doing all the same work. And they grumbled a bit, but they gave it to him. Now he went off to start his own company. He's like, you know what? We can do this work in less time. So everyone only has to work 5 hour days, not 8 hour days. They come in at 8, they leave at 1. They're more efficient, apparently. They say they don't have as much time to like call home or do like personal stuff, but they have more time in their day.
Do they have to like turn their phones off?
Yeah, they have to turn their phones off.
I mean, turning your phone off, that like so, will boom. Save, that's 3 hours right there.
Right there. Yeah. You guys, this is the way it should be in the knowledge worker industry. Can we please just admit, all of us, how much time we waste?
I agree. I have slightly mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, I think obviously like there's that specific law that's like however much time you have, you'll fill up,
yes.
right? But the other thing I'll just say is that part of working in an office, it's just that one of the nice things about being in an office are that time you waste like talking to people like that. You know, so
yeah, but just think.
No, I know what you're saying.
I'm just saying that I
can I just put
the
a counter
wheels, the sociability.
Can I put a counterfactual in here though? Which is if you spent less time making small talk with the people who happen to work in your office and you spent all of that time instead making like actually socially meaningful conversations with your friends and your loved ones, wouldn't that be an improvement?
I mean, perhaps. I mean, it's fair. I mean, like,
it hurts.
No, I do think there's definitely some value here with the idea that, you know, you hear this all the time where people be like, I work 14-hour days. And I'm like, you spend 10 of them doing nothing. So, yeah,
Look, if I'm going to run for president, that is my platform right there. 5 hour days for everybody. Come on.
And one other thing I guess I will say, going back to women issue, is that I often find, and not to stereotype by gender, but that a lot of women, like they're, because they do tend to have more issues outside of work, so they would really benefit from that, potentially.
I'm just going to come out and say I'm in favor of 5 hour work days, but I am against 5 hour work days starting at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Come on, people. If it's only going to be 5 hours, can't we do it from like 11 to 4?
Yeah, I think it should be more flexible. You can start whenever.
I get in at like 7 because I am like, I am a morning person. Like I am because I am useless after like
you
3 p.m.
You get in at 7?
Well, because
media?
I'm useless after.
Amazed by that.
I'm a morning person.
I'm the morning person too, but my commute is 17 hours long. So
fair.
Wait, just wait until you've been a journalist for another like few months. You'll get over it. Okay, I think that's it for us this week. Many thanks for listening to Slate Money. We do appreciate it. Keep the emails coming, slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Jessamine Molly for producing. Stay tuned for a Slate Plus segment all about the crazy conflagration going on in Chile and in other countries. I think you need to hear about that. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
When someone is hurt in a truck accident, the one question everyone has is, why did this terrible collision happen? To answer that question takes an experienced team of lawyers and experts. Not everyone has this type of experience. At Colombo Law, We are truck injury lawyers. It's what we do every day. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.